to order January 19, 2004. We're going to start with the adoption of committee rules just as organizational. I guess I'll tap into an organizational meetings. And in front of you, committee members, you have the rules, committee rules. And Patrick, do you want to say if there's any changes?
I'd like to, Madam Chair. Members, these committee rules are, if you've had previous committees, other committees, you'll recognize them. They're identical to the rules being used by most of the other committees. For the purposes of this committee as a seven-member committee, a quorum is constituted of four members. It requires four members to have a quorum. So in order to go to a work session, we have to have four members in the room. Not necessarily at the dais, I believe anywhere in the room constitutes being present.
Okay.
If in the occasion calls for suspending the rules, five members are required. That's two-thirds require five members for suspension of the rules.
Okay.
And one other change I should mention, and it's probably been mentioned in other committees as well, is that since last session there's been a slight adjustment to the filing of minority reports. Signers of the minority report must be present at the meeting when the vote is taken on the measure, and must be voting no on the final motion. So,
thank you. Are there any questions on the rules? I'll take a motion to adopt the committee rules.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Boquist has moved that we adopt the committee rules. Any objections? Any discussion? So ordered. Now we'll do an introduction of committee members and staff, and I first want to say I'm Representative Patty Smith. I'm chairing this great committee. I want to tell you a little bit about me and why I believe it's important. This is a great committee. We're going to set the tone for public policy in this state on natural resource issues. I think are very important. I think we have great budget problems because of natural resource issues, and I'm very hopeful that we're going to find some good bills coming our way and that we're going to address them in a bipartisan fashion to address the resource issues around this state. So I'm just pleased to be here, and with that, I think we'll introduce the rest of the members, and if you want to say a little bit where you're from, we'll start with Representative Sumner.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'm Max Sumner. I'm from 18th District. That's Malala, Silverton, Mount Angel. We're the poster child of the agricultural and natural resource. Very, very interested in making sure that the people in my district have a way to make a living and a way to make an income. I'm happy to be here and appreciate
you. Thank you. Representative Byer?
Yes, I'm Representative Terry Byer, District 12, which is the city of Springfield. This is my second session on ag and natural resources, and looking forward to working with the chair and the committee. And hopefully we can do some great things in this committee. Thank you.
And I'm Representative Boquist. I represent the 23rd House District, which is portions of five rural counties, starting in Yamhill, Polk, Benton, Lynn, and portions of Marion County, which for the most part, my entire district is ag and natural resources, Madam Chair. And I was born and raised on a dairy farm. I've row cropped, I've raised cattle, and I'm a small woodlands owner. So I'm quite familiar with many of the issues on both sides of the fence. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Early? Well, I guess we should start with Representative Hass. We're doing a quick introduction of committee members.
Mark Hass from Beaverton. This is my third term. I farm 0.25 acres there in Beaverton. Grow mostly green fescue.
That's good.
You mow it once a week.
Thank you. Well, welcome. Representative Burley.
I'm Representative Chuck Burley from Bend. I'm a freshman this year. I'm a certified forester. I've worked in the forest sector my entire career, so this is obviously a very important matter, I think, for us as a whole, for the state, certainly for our constituents in Central Oregon. The wildfires that we've seen over the past several years and all the issues surrounding resource management, whether it's forest or agriculture, are very important to our state, so I really welcome the opportunity to serve here.
And I'm Arnie Roblin. I'm from District 9, which is on the Oregon coast, from Coos Bay up to Florence. Again, very important issues for my constituents, natural resources, from fish to trees to cranberries and other kinds of dairy farms all over the area. But I believe this is a very important committee. It's going to be one that I think will take the forefront on some issues that are important to us as a state. I think we've always been an agriculturally based state. We need to remember our roots as we go through things. And I also look forward to working on ways in which the budget issues and natural resources can come together to solve some of our problems in Oregon.
Gee, great committee, huh? Patrick Brennan, committee administrator, would you like to tell us a little bit about you and introduce Jania?
Yes, thank you. My name is Patrick Brennan. This is my fourth session as a staff for committee services, second as a committee administrator. I was committee administrator for House General Government last session. I had the pleasure of working with you and Representative Beyer during the interim on House Interim Agriculture and Natural Resources, and also staffed the Senate Natural Resources Committee. All sorts of things, including the Noxious Weed Task Force and such things. So, and on my very first session, I was committee assistant for the Senate Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. So I have some background in working on natural resources committees. The other staff person for our committee, Tania Zeeb, this is her first session, her first meeting today. So she's very excited to be here as well.
Great. Welcome. Thank you all very much. Look forward to working with all of you, and as we proceed, I'm sure Patrick will be very helpful with many questions. And don't be afraid to ask questions of people who testify. If you just signal me that you want to ask a question, all the questions go through the chair. We'll be fine. So with that, we'll start our first informational meeting. Do I need to get up? No. Okay. See why I have him. Fire protection program. Thank you and welcome. And for the record, identify yourself, and then we'll just proceed. Thank you.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Charlie Stone. I'm staff for the fire program at the Department of Forestry. And with me this morning is my boss, Tim Keith, Assistant State Forester for the Protection Division. In the past, I've found it very advantageous when testifying to have somebody beside me who can think while I'm talking, and ultimately probably will do some talking while I'm thinking. So we'll share the duties here this morning, but I'll kick off and have the bulk of the discussion. Tim will follow up with a small program at the end here, and hopefully we can keep this thing moving along. As the chair mentioned, the way this presentation is set up, I encourage questions as we go along. I'm going to try to go pretty briskly through some parts and then slow down on others, and if I'm slowing down too much, let me know. So
thank you.
We'll try to keep it moving.
We're going to dim the lights up here a little bit. So.
And can you folks on the end see past that map all right?
Just fine.
Okay. Now, if I can just keep my mouth and the screen in sync here, we'll be moving along. First, I want to start out with a real quick historical perspective on the fire program in Oregon and the Department of Forestry. Back in the early part of the 20th century, there were several large fires in Oregon and in the Northwest. That began to get folks a little bit excited about whether or not the resource would continue to be here. This was a time when the conservation movement was really getting started up, and folks were realizing that positive action had to be taken if natural resources were to continue to provide the economic benefits that they have. A number of companies that owned forest land began to form fire patrols back in that time period. And then after the 1910 fires, which were absolutely devastating in Idaho and to a lesser extent, but still pretty strong in Oregon, then at the federal level, things really started to happen. And the Forest Service was brand new back in those days. There was a lot of debate about whether or not the states or the national government, the federal government, should control forestry and fire. firefighting, that type of thing. Fortunately, I believe they made the right call and made the responsibility primarily that of the states, and the Weeks Law provided some federal funding to assist the states in organizing in that fashion and carrying that out. Now, that's taken several forms over the years, but we still get some federal funding for fire protection in the successor laws to that. In 1911, the Department of Forestry and the Board of Forestry were actually formed by legislative action, and that's when we got our start. And some of the laws that govern fire protection in the state are still the very same laws and language that were adopted in 1911. Not very many of them, but some of the core elements have served us well. After just 2 years of organizing in that fashion, the state passed the compulsory fire patrol law, and at that point, fire protection was mandated on all forest lands in the state. And I think the key then and the key now is that at the base of all this, the landowner in Oregon is responsible for protection from fire on their lands. And that's not the case in all states. In fact, it's relatively unique to Oregon, Washington, to agree Idaho. And while the state does a lot of the work, it's still at the base of it, the landowner responsibility. And while we won't get into it, there's some pretty fine requirements and laws that when fires occur, the landowner can find themselves responsible to bear the costs under certain circumstances. In other cases, because they've paid the state or their association, they're in the clear. At this time, then, the forest protection associations began to form to provide this compulsory fire patrol. They're private nonprofit organizations, covered most of the state back in the early part of the 20th century. And these were landowner organized groups that provided the protection for their own land. It quickly became evident that to be effective and efficient, the lands that of members or landowners who didn't want to join the association still got their protection provided by the association. The law states that the state forester is responsible to protect all lands that aren't otherwise protected by the individual landowner or an association. And currently, today, no individual landowner protects their own land. That mechanism exists in the law, but you can't go it alone. It requires too much resource, and even the giants like Weyerhaeuser and Boise Cascade don't really have the means to do it all on their own, and so they are in these associations. There are still three operating associations today that where the landowners hire their own staff and provide the protection. That's the Coos, the Douglas, and the Walker Range districts that extend across Coos, Curry, and Douglas counties, and then on over into northern Klamath County in the Walker Range Association. All the rest of the forest lands in the state, the areas that are in green on that map up there are our protection districts. And they still have non-operating associations in all those other areas. And these are the landowners who, by a curious mechanism called reverse contract, even though the association exists, they've reversed that contract, and they contract the responsibility back to the state forester for those member lands. In effect, the state forester protects all the lands in those districts. But the landowner associations are very key to the success in this state, I think, because it keeps us honest, keeps us close to the land, and the cost efficiency. We have a really close working relationship and know what's important to the landowners who we're serving. And they keep a pretty close eye on the budgets and make sure that we do what we said we're going to do. The policy for protection from fire in the state is pretty straightforward and simple, is to preserve the forests and to conserve forest resources by prevention and suppression of forest fires. The statute goes on to acknowledge that we need a complete and coordinated protection system. The state forester protects the private lands and some state and government lands. The Forest Service protects the national forest lands. The BLM protects the range lands that they manage out in eastern Oregon. So we've got to have all that system working in sync with each other. And then, of course, other states and other folks as well. And I'll get into that in a little bit more detail in a bit. One of the things that also makes us unique here in Oregon is that our mission priorities are a little bit different than the federal priorities and most other states. While we all put protection of life at the top of the list in terms of priorities, in Oregon, as a matter of statute, we are to protect forest resources second only to protecting life, and structural protection to the extent that it occurs is done in a way that doesn't inhibit the forest resource protection. It's the resource owners that are paying the bill in part, and it's the resource that is what we're set up to protect. Now, we work very closely with the rural fire departments and the state fire marshal's office and other folks to make sure that the structures and that are protected as well, but we have to be careful about how we do that, and that adds a very complicating factor to things. It's a lot more expensive to fight fire in amongst homes and structures, and it's the tactics are different, and so that's one of the issues that we deal with in fire protection. Now I'm going to slow down here a little bit on this table. This is kind of a schematic of how we're organized within the protection program, and at the very top, of course, we're governed by the statutes that you folks are responsible for. Primarily, Chapter 477 in the Oregon Revised Statutes deals with wildland fire protection. The Oregon Board of Forestry is our governing board, and they carry out the responsibility of those statutes, give direction to the state forester in the program. We indicated below that a complete and coordinated fire protection system, and as you look out to the sides of this chart, you see all the different folks that are involved with us, and again, we'll get into that in a little bit more detail here shortly. We're trying to provide protection of the forest resources, minimizing suppression cost plus loss. We're looking at both the cost of fighting fire and the damages, the losses to the landowners when we try to work out the budgets that we're working with. The landowner and the public share in the financing. We involve our partners and cooperators in trying to maintain enhanced forest health. Looking across the bottom of the page there, we divide the program up into five functional areas. Administration, which is everything that you would think it would be, program planning, budgeting, legislative work, program management, training is very important in fire protection. We're in a hazardous type of work, and so it's very important that we be well trained and understand that work so that we can still accomplish our goals without putting people at undue risk. There's rule development and guidance to our field operations and to the folks across the lands. Of course, information management, and then there's a fairly complex assessment system where we fund the program. We have to keep track of all the different tax lots across the state and through the county assessors and through the member associations collect assessments from those landowners to pay for the fire protection, and we'll describe that in more detail in a little bit. Then there's the coordination elements. As I mentioned, there's all kinds of cooperators that we deal with. We have interagency agreements with a number of different agencies to provide resources back and forth. Fire mobilization is something that has to happen rapidly and without hitch. We need to practice that type of thing, so a lot of coordination goes on there. Conflagration management. The governor has authority to declare emergencies and mobilize any state agencies or any state resources when we have fire situations that are beyond the control or the capacity of the resources of, say, a local fire department or a county fire defense board. And so we have that capability. We establish standards across all the different firefighting and police organizations in the state through the public standard fire standards training safety something like
Bureau
that.
Bureau of Public Standard yeah. Safety and Standards Training.
There are certain land use elements. We participate with county governments in making sure that they design their land use zoning and codes to recognize the hazards of fire. We work with the federal government to acquire property, equipment at a low cost that we pass on to rural fire departments, use some of it ourselves, and work with the Federal Emergency Management Administration, primarily in a role where they send money, and that becomes very important at times. prevention, key element. The least expensive fire to fight is the one that you don't have, and so we try to prevent fires wherever we can. We have a plans and studies group where we try to look into fire causes, figure out ways to enhance our fire prevention, dealing with equipment starts, with industrial fire prevention. Used to be that a large portion of our fire starts came from the forest industry itself, with the logging practices back in the first half of the last century. Fortunately, in the past two or three decades, those have gone way down, but the population has grown, and human-caused fires of other nature have increased. We don't mention it here, but we have a very close relationship with a nonprofit organization, the Keep Oregon Green Association, who provide mass media fire prevention efforts and try to educate the public about fire prevention, fire suppression. Within our prevention program, we investigate every fire that we operate on, and try to determine the cause of that fire, and both for the purpose of prevention and when there's a responsible party that is negligent or even malicious in the start of a fire, then we have the authority to recover the costs of suppression for the fire. And so that acts as a deterrent for future fires as well. It's a very important part of the prevention effort. Excuse me. Over in the operations section, that's where we fight fires, basically. And we've got folks throughout the state, about 30 different unit offices and subunit offices beyond that, guard station. We've got people and equipment scattered all over the forest of the state. We have a section that deals with fire weather and forecasting in our Salem offices. We have three meteorologists on staff. Their work primarily deals with smoke management, but in the summertime they also do fire weather forecasting. But we're also tied into the National Weather Service and the Coordination Center in Portland, where we get a lot of that work as well. There's a fire cache at our Salem headquarters where we can equip larger fires. We have three complete fire support systems that involve kitchens, showers, communication trailers, mapping units that we can send out to the larger fires and support them. We maintain three incident management teams that are trained fire overhead that train and function together and can be mobilized within a few hours' time to any place in the state and take over a large project fire. And for that matter, we send them sometimes to other states, but that's fairly rare because we keep pretty close touch on them to make sure that we're covered here at home. We have a contract with the Bureau of Land Management. Again, I'll cover some of these things again, but we provide the protection for all the Western Oregon BLM lands because they're intermingled with the private land so closely. And we maintain contracts and agreements with lots of other folks to help us in firefighting. That's all works through our operations section. Finally, there's the Fuels and Smoke Management Group, which technically, if you were on Ways and Means, you'd be looking at them a little bit different, but smoke management is actually part of our Forest Practices Program because they deal with air quality and they're funded in that fashion, but they're housed within the fire program. They get their direction from Tim and from the fire program director, Bill Lafferty, and they operate within us because smoke management and fuels management is all very key in maintaining fires. We issue burning permits and that type of thing to make sure that it's again part of our prevention efforts. It's a very broad and complex program, as you can see from all of that. We're organized statewide into three areas: the northern area, the southern Oregon area, which is part of Linn County and all of Lane County south. And then the northwest, of course, is west of the Cascades, north of the southern Oregon area, and the eastern Oregon area, which is everything east of the summit of the Cascades. Depending on how you count them, 15 districts around the state. There are 15 administrative districts. There are 12 protection districts or associations. There are three operating associations. There's all kinds of different combinations of the way that that occurs. And I guess maybe the real message there is that none of that should matter to anybody, because when it comes to fighting fire, it's all seamless. Everybody trains the same. Everybody shares resources. And so that it's a little complicated if you look at our organization charts, but that doesn't create any significant difficulties for us. Again, we have a complete and coordinated system. In Salem, at our headquarters, we have what we call the Salem Coordination Center that coordinates all of our statewide large fire operations and aircraft operations. It's linked to the Northwest Coordination Center, which serves all of the firefighting jurisdictions in Oregon and Washington, and shares resources through that. And that's linked, again, to the National Interagency Coordination Center in Boise, Idaho, that runs the firefighting system for the entire nation. And then if you want to go beyond that, Canada has a similar system, and they talk to each other on a daily basis as well. We have several agreements, particularly with the U.S. Forest Service and the four Department of Interior firefighting land management agencies. That would be the Bureau of Land Management, the National Park Service, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And all of those agencies are represented with protection responsibilities in Oregon, BLM and the Forest Service being the largest, but the other three are present, and we do work with them. We, as I mentioned before, cooperate closely with rural fire departments and the fire marshal's office, and we're a member of the Northwest Compact, which is a group that shares firefighting resources on request, and that involves Alaska, Washington, Idaho, Montana, the provinces of British Columbia, Alberta, and the Yukon, and the Northwest Territories. And with a couple phone calls between the states, we can get an air tanker down from Alaska or inmate kitchen crews from Washington if we're tapped out and they have resources available, they'll be on the road within a couple of hours. And we do the same, sharing and providing resources to them. Again, this is a more simplified map of the forest protection districts. If you're at all familiar with the forest lands of the state, you'll recognize that within those districts includes all of the national forest land. The way the districts are drawn, it includes them, but they provide their own protection in that. The way the fire laws are organized, the Chapter 477 applies within or within an eighth of a mile of a forest protection district. So anything that, in terms of the restrictions and the mechanisms for applying the laws to those lands, applies through the forest protection districts. About half of that area is actually ODF's protection, the forest lands in Oregon. Real general terms, about 30 million acres. The state's about 61 million acres, and ODF protects about 16 million acres of that forest land. So we have about a quarter of the state that we cover. BLM, let's see if I can work this gadget here. BLM protects a lot of the area out here. This is rangeland, and then scattered areas up in other parts of the state. And so altogether, a large part of the state is covered. I suppose I should wait till another map, but I've started down this path now. The Willamette Valley does not have any wildland protection, but is almost entirely covered by rural fire districts. There's one significant hole right about in here in the Bell Fountain area that the landowners there choose not to belong to rural fire departments. The Crater Lake, of course, has the Park Service protecting it. Warm Springs Reservation, the BIA, there are wildlife refuges in various places in the state that Fish and Wildlife Service protects. And yet there's about 6 million acres in the state that has no water and fire protection or any structural protection on a lot of that as well. And that's an issue that you may see later in this session or in future sessions. It's been around for a number of years. It causes difficulties in terms when there are fires burning in those areas that nobody has responsibility for, and they start to approach areas that people are paying for protection. Who's gonna deal with that large fire front when it approaches paying lands? That is really the key to that issue. Probably just Got myself all out of order here, but we'll try to make it get back to the right place.
How are you doing tonight?
We're not getting many questions yet. I hope that means that you're getting good information. I mentioned that there are intermingled lands of the BLM in Western Oregon. That's an artifact of the old Oregon and California Railroad that didn't get built, and the lands reverted back to the BLM. Again, because that's every other section in a checkerboard pattern, it just wouldn't be practical at all to have two different jurisdictions providing fire protection. We've had a contract now for, I think, 52 or 53 years with the BLM where we provide the protection for that land. They cooperate completely. It's a wonderful cooperative relationship. We treat them just like any other forest landowner, as we do the state forest lands and county lands. They do have different land management goals, and there are times when, as a result of that, they have to request that we take special measures in the way that we provide our tactics. We still have the final say and decision on whether or not to apply those in order to maintain safe, aggressive firefighting. But if those extra elements cost more than it would have to fight fire in the way we would traditionally on other lands, then the Bureau makes up those additional costs, and it's a good working relationship. By the same token, any landowner who has a fire that we're fighting under the statutes can request that we take special measures and protect things in a different fashion. Again, the state forester has the final say as whether that is practical or not and is going to do the job. But we will honor those requests where we can do so without jeopardizing other lands and drastically changing the cost structure. In terms of the resources that we bring to the party, so to speak, and I want to make a disclaimer now. If I were in front of Ways and Means and putting up these kinds of numbers, I'd have to do a whole lot more homework and make sure that it was more precise, and I haven't been in this case. These are general numbers, particularly the FTE and positions, because that's been changing so much over the last couple of years. We never know whether we're dealing with a proposal or the real, or we've had changes with the special sessions not too many years ago. But overall, in a general sense, we have about 350 FTE in the fire program, scattered over more like 600 or 700 positions. 500 to 550 of those are seasonal firefighter positions that come on primarily in the period from May to October. We have scattered around the state 230 engines and tenders, which are our primary means of initial attack on fires. We have 13 dozers that are owned and operated by the department, with many others on contract or available in standby by the forest operators and landowners. And while lookouts have gone out of vogue in many areas, and we used to have a lot more around the state, we still maintain and operate 32 lookouts in areas where that's the most practical way to detect fire in a rapid fashion. And even though most of our fires are reported by the public or by other means currently, the cost is so little relative to the ability to pinpoint a fire. If you've taken cross shots between lookouts or to have somebody out there on the forest, it still pays its own way in many cases. One fire detected more rapidly that keeps us from spending $3 million on a project fire doesn't even come close to the cost of keeping those lookouts up. So some districts maintain more, some don't, and some less is geographically distributed, but we still do that type of work. And before I go on down the list, those first four elements are really the key to our initial attack operation. Initial attack is where it's at in firefighting. You're going to hear more about this as we bring a bill before you next week. The key, again, I said the cheapest fire is the one not fought because you've prevented it, but after that it's the fires that are kept small, and we're all about trying to keep the fire small, knocking them down within just the first couple of hours of report, and that keeps our costs way down. When you get into extended attack and bringing in additional resources and campaign type fires, that's when you start talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars, and we're trying to stay out of that arena. But The conditions don't always allow that to happen. Some fires don't get reported. Sometimes the weather conditions, the winds are such that fire is just off and running from the start, and there's no catching up to it till you get a break in the weather. And that's why we have a whole lot of other resources available to us. The other programs within the department, the state forest program, the private community forests, and the administrative folks in Salem, the bulk of those people are trained as fire overhead and become our militia when we have larger fires, and they're taken off their normal jobs and pressed into duty within the fire program. As I mentioned before, we have three incident management teams and the three fire cache support systems that come to bear when we have larger fires. Then we have all kinds of cooperator resources. First and foremost, the landowners and operators who are out there working on the ground are able to provide us overhead engines, tenders, dozers, helicopters. Some of the companies maintain their own fire caches for additional equipment and can bring on folks. Some have a lot of trained overhead. Some have just a few and can provide someone who knows the land and a pickup truck, but it's all helpful. Within the Department of Corrections, we have 24 10-man trained inmate crews. Of course, those turn over, and we're training them constantly throughout the summer, working with those folks, but they provide a ready resource that we can mobilize in short term. It also serves our Measure 11 purposes of keeping the inmates occupied. That's not the word I'm looking for, but employed. Several of the institutions now also provide kitchen support throughout most of the institutions. They feed themselves. They have inmates trained to cook and provide that support, and we can bring them out into our fire cache kitchens. In fact, we prefer to use the inmate cook crews. They do an excellent job for us. And so we have that resource, tremendous relationship between us and the DOC that we want to expand at every opportunity, even though there are issues as well with the contract crew folks. And I know that creates some tension at times, but because we do have Measure 11, the inmates are a ready resource. We need to maintain that. And don't forget that, the landowners and the people of the state are paying for that fire protection. Wherever we can maintain those costs as low as possible, we're doing a service to folks. So that's a key there. We do have 234 20-person contract crews available to us right now through an interagency agreement that ODF manages on behalf of all the other resource agencies in Oregon and Washington. Similarly, the Forest Service maintains an agreement for engines and tenders from contractors, and we all participate in the use of those resources. They can go out of state, they can go anywhere in the country through the various compacts and whatnot, and we can still end up with a drawdown situation that causes us difficulty in high fire years, but they're created primarily for use in the Northwest here. I mentioned at several junctures the fire marshal's office. They also maintain three incident management teams that can move in on conflagration situations, work again seamlessly. We train together with their teams, and this year's fire team training will take place in the first week of March, I think. All three of our teams and all three of the fire marshal teams will get together and have exercises, work out issues, and make sure that we're ready to go when the fire season comes so that they can protect the structures, we can protect the wild land and keep it all going together. At times we have to draw on the Oregon National Guard. Their available resources at this point are somewhat otherwise occupied, but we still have helicopter resources available to us in the state that we can call out when all other commercial heavy helicopter resources are occupied. And then I mentioned FEMA. We just call on them when we need some help paying for things. When fires threaten structures in mass or communities, then we can get an emergency declaration and become eligible for FEMA reimbursement up to 75% of the eligible costs. And that typically happens at least a couple of times a year where we have fires of that type. This last year, the Bland Mountain Fire and the Redwood Highway Fire down in Cave Junction pose significant threats to the communities of Cave Junction and Days Creek, thanks to him. And we were able to get that declaration early on in those fires, and we're going to get reimbursed some probably $5 to $6 million out of about a $7.5 million cost on those two fires, and so that makes a big difference for us. And also the federal agencies, and really this is the largest bunch of resources available to us. You're probably all familiar with the National Air Tanker Contract. That's going to be one of our issues this year as well as last year, but resources that we can call on when they're available. They also maintain all kinds of fire overhead engines, helicopters, et cetera, and we can draw across the entire nation through the federal agencies for resources. Another issue or area of concern, thing that complicates firefighting in this state, within that 16 million acres of fire protection districts, there are about 3.5 million acres we consider to be a wildland-urban interface, or areas that where structures and homes are dense enough to present a significant complication for our firefighting efforts. In 1997, the legislature recognized this issue and passed Senate Bill 360, which is a program that requires landowners to, first of all, it requires the local county to examine the interface and to classify it within their county, determine which zones are interface, and to classify the interface within that within five different categories, or up to five categories. I think we may have only four in the two pilot counties so far. And then the landowners in that interface area are expected to, or are encouraged to maintain their land in a fire-safe condition by maintaining the fuels, moving it back, clearing around their homes, keeping their driveways open so that structural firefighting equipment as well as our equipment can get in and out safely. There are a number of different factors dealing with roofing and siding, that type of thing. It isn't an absolute mandate that they do this, but if they don't, once their area has been zoned as interface, then if a fire occurs on land that hasn't been treated in this fashion, they can incur additional liability for fire suppression costs. The legislature asked us to implement this slowly and gradually to make sure that we work the bugs out as we go and build support for it. And so here we are in 2005 now. And last year we got to the point finally where the first two pilot counties, Deschutes and Jackson County, have designated their areas, and Deschutes County has begun the mailing process and put folks on notice that they are in an interface area, and have told them they've now got 2 years to get in compliance with those requirements if they want to avoid the potential costs. Jackson County, I think, is just now identifying those areas and notifying people. Soon we'll be moving this process on to Klamath County, the Northeast Oregon District counties, other counties surrounding Deschutes in Central Oregon District and Douglas. And then as we move through those, then we'll expand out into other areas. I hope you can see the difference in shading either on your copy or up there on the screen. But the darker areas are the areas that we've determined, not that the counties have necessarily identified yet, but through our processes have identified as interface. As I mentioned, you see this concentration in Jackson County, and these are areas also that have a lot of fuel issues and are highly susceptible to frequent wildfires. And then in Deschutes County here, we're doing that. We're expanding. You kind of see the interface right down the Highway 97 corridor down into Klamath County here, and that's going to be one of the next areas of concentration. More scattered, but again, because of the fuels issues, Northeast Oregon, we're going to tackle that pretty soon. Be up into Hood River and Wasco County and Crook County. Now, there's a lot of interface area around the Willamette Valley fringe and up and down the coast. But also the frequency and intensity of fire in these areas typically isn't quite the same. It can be, and it's we're kind of juggling priorities here. It's certainly a worry to me, having worked on the coast a lot and the kinds of fuels that we have in amongst homes over there. It's frightening you to death if you thought about it too much. But again, you have to have all the conditions line up to have a large fire situation in those areas, and hopefully we don't face that before we get to those areas. It's not that those areas won't burn. Yes, Representative Burley.
I was curious, these letters that you're sending to the landowners that are going to inform them that they're now in the upper phase and they need to comply, what kind of assistance is ODF or the county or whomever going to provide these landowners to help them get that work done?
Yes, Representative Burley, we have... The Act itself, Senate Bill 360, doesn't provide any direct assistance. It does allow us to assess those lands additionally, which we are not doing and don't propose to do anytime soon. And that money could be spent back on implementing the bill. But we do have quite a number and a lot of money that's coming in through National Fire Plan grants. Of course, the nation as a whole recognized this issue with the big fires back in 2000, primarily in Montana and Idaho. And so now there's a whole federal effort to do community wildfire planning, to educate folks on the issues, and then fuels modification grants that we're able to apply for and funnel through back to the community. And we, by and large, do that through local organizations. Some of it we do directly with contractors, but we make some money available to folks as we get those grants. Typically about $500 per tax lot that we can make available to folks when we get those grants to do the clearing work. But ultimately, this is get them started, get them to understand what needs to be done type of money. It won't go on forever, and the landowners are still going to need to maintain that. Hopefully we can get them to understand that they have a responsibility and that they can benefit from that.
In the Upper Deschutes area, the communities there have completed, to my knowledge, probably the first community wildfire protection plan to be completed in the state, certainly in Deschutes County. And I know that they're struggling trying to get some money. They've looked at National Fire Plan grants. What can we do to help them get the funding they need to implement that plan?
Well, we'll continue to attempt to get those grants. We're competing with all the states and with all the areas in the state. We have funneled money in that direction in the past. I know that there's an issue right now. There's a concern that the Department of Forestry, for some reason, has, so to speak, iced them out of some of the grants. That's simply not the case, but as we try to reach all the areas, and one of our priority mechanisms is to look at areas that haven't gotten any grant money so far that have concern, and so we're trying to spread that money around. But we will continue to work with them to try to get money as we can make those proposals attractive and outcompete the other states.
Yeah, I was interested as also, we're talking about this interface. Are people in these interfaces, can they belong to these associations that we talked about?
Representative Roblin, they can. Of course, membership is a matter of the members in the association, so they actually vote on bringing anybody in who applies for membership into the association. And typically they're looking to the folks with the larger ownerships in terms of, and because there's a certain amount of influence that goes along with the association membership and looking at the budgets, they want to make sure that the interests of the association and its members are well represented. But there's no bar to anyone that has forest land belonging to those associations.
Okay.
And it's an interesting, if you look at the 12 associations around the state, some of them have as few as, only a dozen or so members, mostly large landowners, and others have, 40, 50 members that represent all kinds of sizes of ownership. So it's across the board.
Thank you. I've asked the committee administrator, Patrick, to give you a copy of that Senate bill, or the committee if they want it, a copy of that Senate bill on the end. See how it was implemented.
Okay.
We can follow up on that if you need to.
Okay.
Is that SB 360 now?
Yes.
It's now codified in the ORS's. And I can't give you the site off the top of my head, but it's in Chapter 477.
And we did that in the 2001 session. I remember that. Right?
Actually, it was the 1997 session. It's been, like I said, it's been a slow, gradual process of bringing that that forward. But as we've been able to get grants to fund our effort, we've really stepped up. Really, about 2001 is when we really kicked it into high gear and got it moving now.
Well, maybe what we'll do is follow up on that. If we need to do more on that, we certainly will.
And we've got others who are better able to address the issue than me, and if you want to bring those folks back for additional questions.
In fact, I was going to follow up and ask that we do that, because apparently in this Upper Deschutes area, one of the problems that manifested itself with 360 was the vacant lot issue.
Right.
So I think that is a policy question we may need to take a look at.
Representative Burley, Chair Smith, you're absolutely correct. And the way the bill or the law is written right now, it doesn't address the vacant lots very directly, because the mechanisms are primarily clearance around the structure. And yet there's a lot of small lots that don't have a structure on them and that are choked with fuels. We recognize that as an issue, but it's 360 is kind of a stepwise process, and there was a lot of concern initially that if we tried to move too far too fast, there'd be a pushback that would kill it, basically, and we want to make it successful.
Great. Duly noted.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Now, this map is similar to the one that's on the board over there in what it tries to show. I don't know what color you call that. The kind of brownish is BLM jurisdiction, and you can see it checkerboarded all through western Oregon here as well. The pale green is the national forest land, and but there's some overlaps here. The blue is designates ODF's protection. You can see how broken up it is over on the east side, which is an issue in itself, but. Those are the private lands that ODF protects in eastern Oregon. Up here, the darker color and scattered through western Oregon, that's state-owned land, the Elliott State Forest and the Tillamook and Clatsop Forest, but again, ODF protected. And the yellow areas here are what we call rangeland protection associations. And Ironside Association has existed for, I think, some 40 years now or so. But most of the rest of those areas, again, were responses to concerns about unprotected lands in the last 7-8 years. And we're working to try and encourage the ranchers and the landowners in these areas to form these associations to deal with their own protection throughout the unprotected areas. Actually, this map doesn't include the two most recently protected areas of the Twickenham Rangeland Association right in here, and the Silver Creek Rangeland Association down here in Harney County. But we're working with other folks to try and encourage that. And there are some issues in terms of costs and liabilities, and we may be back maybe before this committee later in the session, if we can get that effort organized, to try and help find some solutions that help those associations. And ultimately, when we work out the issues with the folks on the east side, again, this is one of those things where if we push too hard, we get pushed back, and so we're trying to work it, but there may be efforts to establish more of a landowner responsibility in these areas like we have on the forest lands. It doesn't exist currently in the law. Is that everything we want to talk about in terms of jurisdictions? I think so. Now we're going to shift to how we fund the program, and I talked about those district associations. They each have a budget committee. They watch very closely. In fact, generally tell us what the level of protection they think ought to be. It's really a cooperative venture. But ultimately, each association has to adopt and pass its budget before it goes to the Board of Forestry for approval. Now, these are annual fiscal year budgets that they adopt. It all fits within the state's biennial budgeting, but actually is more in depth and closer to the people in the than the oversight that we get from you folks and from the Department of Administrative Services. Once a budget is developed for the district, then an assessment rate is determined. And for private landowners, that's half of the overall cost, because the general fund provides that other half on a 50-50 basis. The public landowners, the BLM, the state lands, the county forests, they pay the full assessment rate. And those range anywhere from in the neighborhood of 50 cents an acre for the private landowner in some of the west side districts up to, I think the maximum right now is $1.18 an acre in the Central Oregon and Walker Range districts, where they have a lot of fuels issues and firefighting is more costly. Each year, if the district in its regular district budget spends more than it budgeted for because of overtime issues and that type of thing within the let me backtrack a moment. The district budget provides for the existence of the fire department, all those engines and people that I talked about, and finances the initial attack part of fires. Those regularly budgeted district resources paid out of the district budget. When we have to attack a fire with more than that provides, whether it's helicopters or air tankers or additional crews or a fire expands, then we call those emergency costs, and they're funded through another emergency cost structure, and I'll get to that in a moment. But the district budget, if it has a debit or a credit at the end of the fiscal year, then that's moved forward into the next year's budget, and they either lower the rate or increase the rate to cover that occurrence. Then we have the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund, which is the basis of the emergency cost structure, and it currently buys insurance on top of its funding, and I'll get into all this in more detail. As I mentioned before, we try to collect the costs, and that goes back as a credit when we're able to do that, and goes back to the appropriate place, whether it's to cover the emergency funds and goes back to the first the insurance. If we are paid, we have to repay the insurance. And then to the fund itself, and eventually down to the district level if we collect the local district costs. This is a diagram that's intended to describe how we determine the appropriate or the most efficient level of funding for the district. This is as much art as it is science. We do initial attack analyses that put a fire out on the model a fire on the landscape and determine what it would take to get resources there, how much that's going to cost, how effective it is. What we're really looking for is the combination of the least cost for suppression and the least loss for damages. If you look at that line that climbs from left to right, what that indicates is that the more money you spend on resources, that is the increasing line of resources spent, and that drives down this line, which is the loss line. So the more money you spend, the less you lose, theoretically. And somewhere, this line is the combination of the two. You want to try and hit that the sweet spot somewhere in there that meets the two of those. Now, when I say art more than science, we also draw on our experience and what has worked in the past. And ultimately, what we're really doing here is trying to deal with the average worst season. It's not the worst case scenario that we can face and we know we will face from time to time. But if you take, for instance, the worst 3 years out of the last 10 and average that, that's what we call the average worst season. We're trying to budget to have enough resources to deal with that. When you get a lightning bust like we did July 12th through the 14th in 2002, what, 13,000 lightning strikes, something like that, over a 3 or 4 day period, and we had several hundred starts come out of that. It overwhelms the system, and you can't, you know, it's not practical to budget to the levels that where you could deal with all of that. But you want to recognize when those types of situations are coming if you can. And this is where we talk about severity resources, a fairly recent concept. Where we try to make available additional resources, and the legislature through Ways and Means has made available additional funding for us, that if we can predict those few days or an oncoming storm where the conditions are going to be much worse, and we'll go out and hire additional resources through contractors and have them on standby for initial attack. And we've proven the success of that effort, particularly in the last two fire seasons. If you think back to 2001 and 2002, when we, in the 2 years, burned 150,000 acres on ODF protected lands in the state, and did not have that kind of intensive resource, and the system got overwhelmed. In 2003, we actually had similar fire danger conditions. We set new records, worse than the years before, in terms of fire severity, in terms of the fuel conditions and weather conditions. We didn't quite have the same types of starts from dry lightning storms. But by the use of severity resources and aggressive initial attack, we kept down to 9,000 acres burned in 2003. And we think that, some of that's luck and some of it's weather conditions, but a lot of it was having those additional resources at the right time in the right place. And so that's going to be another issue that we'll be back talking about with this bill that we'll be bringing forward next week. Now, the overall funding structure, and I don't intend to get into this in detail at the moment. We will at a later time. But the horizontal block here signifies the regular district budgets and the initial attack component, and the vertical block deals with the emergency costs. The district budgets, as we've indicated, have 50-50 sharing between the landowner assessments and the general fund. The public owners carry the full cost of their assessment down there. And then the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund in this biennium, sunsets at the end of this biennium, provides for up to the first $15 million in emergency costs through a revolving fund that the landowners pay into annually. And then we have insurance coverage above a $15 million deductible currently for another $25 million in coverage. But the premium comes out of that OFLPF currently, and that's for this the past fire season was $3,875,000 for that insurance premium. So it's a significant cost to us every year, whether we draw on that fund or not. The sources that the landowners pay into the OFLPF, and it's annually it's about between $7.5 million and $8 million a year that goes into this fund. Comes 4 cents an acre from Western Oregon timberlands, 6 cents an acre from Eastern Oregon timberlands or grazing lands anywhere in the state, and there are significant grazing lands in Coos Douglas and Southwest districts on the west side. All timber harvested in the state, both on federal land and private state lands, has a harvest tax or privilege tax of 50 cents per thousand board feet that goes into the fund. And any tax lot, regardless of the acreage, I mean, if it's below a certain acre, still has to pay at least $3, so we call it $3 minimum, $3 minimum charge for those lots. A lot of the large landowners, they're paying, you know, hundreds or thousands of dollars, but every lot pays at least $3. And any lot with an improvement on it, as determined by the county assessor, has a $38 surcharge that goes into the fund, and that addresses the issue of the complications of the wildland-urban interface and how much more expensive it is to fight fire in those areas. Not to mention the fact that there's a lot more of the populace in those areas, and they start their share of fires in those areas as well. Now, I'm going to spare you detail on this chart for the moment. But this is our insurance history. We've had the program now for 30 years, and the numbers are pretty modest in the early years, up to as much as $43 million of coverage back in the late 90s. And what I really want to look at is just the totals at the bottom. And I know you folks in the audience can't read those numbers there, but the total premium cost through the 2003 fire season was about $42.5 million. And the amount that was paid out by the insurance companies in claims above and beyond what the OFLPF paid for was $52 million. So we're actually ahead of the insurance companies at this point. Now, they're rapidly gaining back on us, and they will undoubtedly. actually, if you add in the 2004 fire season where we paid another $3.9 million in premium and didn't make any claim, that's lowered the difference. So we're about $5.7 million ahead of them at this point. And hopefully we won't have any claims for the next several years because we don't want to have large fires. And it won't be but a couple more years where they'll get back on top. But that's okay, because think about if the general fund had to ride those highs and lows when we have a $25 million emergency fire season. The system has worked out. It's cost beneficial. We intend to propose to you to continue that system. Is there a question?
No.
Okay. Now, quickly, we're just going to recap kind of our experience with the department and capture some issues, and we're winding down probably maybe another 10 minutes or so, I think, here before we turn it back to the committee. This is a history of the number of fires on our jurisdiction back to 1960. You can see there's a fair amount of variability there, but overall, the average of the last 20 years, we typically fight about 1,150 fires per season. That's the 20-year average currently. I couldn't swear to it. I haven't looked lately at the trend line, but I think there's a slightly decreasing trend line in there. Hard to see. We know that if you look back over the 90-year history, it would be decreasing. When we talk about acres burned, a lot more highly variable, and again, because of the types of season, once you get an escape fire, no telling where you're going to stop, and that drives those big fire years. The top line there is 100,000 acres. Prior to 1951, in the 40 years that we'd been in existence, we had, I think, something like 18 years where we had more than 100,000 acres burned in the state. Of course, we didn't have the type of resources and system we have now. We've not burned more than 100,000 acres since 1951, although we came close, unfortunately, in 1987 and in 2002. But our average for the last 10 years is about 24,000 acres burned. If you go back 40 years or so, about 16,000 acres. And depending when you have those surges, it bounces back and forth in that realm. But if we can keep the fires to less than 0.1% of the total land area, we think we're doing a pretty good job. Yes, Representative Robles.
So these amounts do not include federal lands.
They do not. This is just the land that the Department of Forestry protects.
Along with the other associations, right?
Yeah, if you took into account all forest land, or actually all wild lands in the state of Oregon, in 2002, I think we burnt just under 1 million acres statewide. Here are the two key performance measures that we report during our budget process for the program. We have several others that deal with the smoke management program, but we try to maintain more than 94% of all fires stopped at 10 acres or less. And this only goes up through 2001. You can see from 1990 to 2001, we were above that line the entire time. When we update this chart and include the last couple fire years, unfortunately, 2002 was the first time in all this period we only captured 92.8% of our fires less than 10 acres. We had we got overwhelmed with the lightning in that middle July period. But 2003, we were back up to 95%, and 2004 is even going to be higher than that, I believe, although we haven't done the work yet on the statistics. The other key statistic is the number of human-caused wildland fires. Here it shows as per 1,000 citizens. As we now report, it's per 100,000, but either way you look at it, if you make it 100,000, this line then would be 20, or actually it would be 27 fires per 100,000 population. So lower is better. We want to be below that line. And most years we are. The last 2 years we were again below that line at... I'm getting off my script here, but here we go. 2002, 24.8 per 100,000, and 2003, 23.2 per 100,000. So still well below the line there. This looks at all jurisdictions in all of Oregon and Washington, so the five federal agencies, the Department of Natural Resources in Washington and Oregon. This is where we get to brag a little bit and show off here. What we're looking at is in the green bar, the percentage of land, or percentage of fires that start, and the red, excuse me, I got that backwards. The red bar is the percentage of fires, and the green bar is the percentage of acres burned. ODF protects about 25% of the total land base in the two states. We have about 25% of the fire starts, as indicated by this bar graph, but we only burn about 6% of the acres year in and year out. And that's attributable, I think, well, there are condition issues. For instance, the BLM protects primarily rangeland, and their fires are wind-driven, fast-moving fires. They can burn 50,000, 100,000 acres in a burn period, and then the sun goes down, and they get a line around it and capture it. But on the other end of the spectrum, the National Park Service, most of their lands are at high elevation in the Cascades and don't experience a lot of large fire growth. Still, we think initial attack, aggressive initial attack, and the cooperative system that we have is a big part of why our numbers are so different than some of the other folks there. Short-term issues heading into the 2005 fire season. Some that you'll see here in this committee, others maybe not. Emergency funding and severity and insurance, and this is all dealt with in House Bill 2327, which we hope to have in front of you for a hearing next week, and we'll get into a lot more detail at that time. Aviation resources. I've mentioned briefly before that the National Air Tanker contract, which used to provide 44 large air tankers across the nation, was suspended last year, and we're looking at probably having 8 large air tankers available for the whole nation next year. They're working at trying to bring back more, but that's going to be a critical concern that we'll be working on throughout the spring. Last year, this came on us very suddenly in May, and we reacted. We hired, contracted 4 air tankers for the Department of Forestry. We don't think we're going to be able to do that again this year, but we hope to contract 2 probably. And then we also contracted 7 medium and heavy helicopters, and we probably won't initially do that. If any, we might put on 1 or 2, but we've got to get a better idea of what the federal government is going to have on hand and what they can guarantee us will stay here in Oregon, as opposed to most of their resources are considered national resources, and they can be gone at any time. And so we have to know what we can rely on here in Oregon and then determine what we're going to need, and as well as look at the conditions. 16 and 17 year old firefighters. In Oregon, we employ youth firefighters. Douglas County and Coos County in particular have over 100 youth employed as firefighters. We think it's a key piece of getting folks into the business, training them up. We've had no serious accidents with youth firefighters. They're very closely supervised by experienced firefighters. We think it's a key issue, and yet there hasn't been any noticeable movement, but we're following closely that there's been a petition to the U.S. Department of Labor to declare firefighting a hazardous activity, which then would mean that nobody under the age of 18 can engage in that activity for hire. And so that's something we may be back to the committee at a later time, maybe asking for a memorial to the federal government or something of that nature to represent our concern about that. Now, not all states are in agreement about this, but several key states, Florida, Nevada, Oregon, Washington, use youth crews, and it's very important to us, and we want to maintain that.
I would just concur with that. In Coos County, in our protection district, that's been a really good source of training for people who have actually worked right into the program, and I think it's a valuable thing to protect. So.
Thank you. And then firefighter liability. In the last few years, the 30-mile fire up in Washington State, and then last year, 2003, the Kramer fire in Idaho, both were situations where firefighters lost their lives, and the ensuing investigations determined that a number of factors occurred, but incident commanders and local line staff responsible for those firefighting organizations were held responsible for those occurrences. I don't mean to say that there aren't times when people have to be held accountable, but at the same time, this is a very dangerous business. We've got to be able to have our fire managers know that they can do the job, fight fire aggressively, be supported by the people that hire them to do that work. And so the liability of those firefighters has become a very important concern, and the ability to continue to get people to take those jobs and those very difficult responsibilities. Tim here is a what we call a Type 1 incident commander, and trained and qualified. And those folks are few and far between. They're highly qualified. They literally lose sleep and lose years of their lives worrying about the people that they put out there on the fire lines. And we've got to support those people. We have a bill in on the Senate side this session that is trying to make some fine adjustments to the bill that actually passed last session. There were some issues with concerns about the constitutionality of that. The particular issue deals with providing some liability limits to our association firefighters that are already available to the state's employees. We want to cover them in the same way. It's a seamless operation, but because they're privately employed, there's a little bit different situation. So probably won't see that bill in this committee. I would imagine it'll be assigned to the Judiciary Committee, but you will hopefully eventually see it on the floor. And again, we'll be looking for your support in that area. It's too early to be making predictions about the 2000 fire season. Anything can happen, but the we're only at about 50% of our rainfall here on the west side so far this winter. And if things don't change drastically, then hang on. It's too early to tell, but there's nothing that says right now that we're not going to have the similar types of circumstances setting up as we did in the 2002 fire season. That's the kind of weather we had that winter. So I hope that's not the case, but we've got to be aware of that. Longer-term issues, you can read them up there on the screen. Tim's going to get into several of these here as we talk about our fire program review briefly as the last item here. But I wanted to mention the last item on the bullet chart there, and that's maintaining our ability to employ aggressive firefighting tactics. Now, I talked about that a little bit via the firefighter liability issue, but it seems forever we've been facing just little things here and there, that whether it's safety rules or bureaucratic paperwork type issues, things that eat into our ability to really put people on the ground fast, fight fire safely but aggressively in the way that we know how to. The youth firefighting item is kind of a piece of that. Currently the federal OSHA rules that deal with harvesting talk about weather conditions and night conditions that are unsafe, and if you can't operate, then you don't operate. And while there hasn't been any move explicitly to limit us, one of the worst things that could possibly happen would be to somebody to determine that fighting fire at night is too hazardous and you can't do it. On the contrary, it's when we make our most progress, it really makes it safer to fight fire during the daytime to be able to fight fire aggressively at night. We have to maintain the ability to do that. It's one of the major differences in the way that we fight fire typically. And when things cool down at night, when the humidities come up, when the winds die down, that's when we really make hay, and we've got to be able to do that. So that's probably not anything that's going to come before the committee, but something that's always on our radar screen. The other thing I believe the committee administrators have passed to you, there's a copy of our fire program strategic plan in front of you, and I'm not going to go into that, but it deals with a lot of these same long-term and short-term issues and the things that Tim's going to talk about. So if you are interested in that, you can look at the vital actions that we have targeted for the next several years in the program that address these issues. Now I'm going to have to fiddle with the computer for a moment as Tim gets ready to talk to you about the fire program review.
Thank you. Representative Sumner.
Madam Chair, I'd like to ask a question just to dispel, I hope, a myth. Back to your second slide, noticed huge fires around the turn of the 20th century. And some of the old folks around my home absolutely insist that early settlers would intentionally torch forests to create agriculture and grazing land. Can you dispel that myth, or is it true?
Well, I think that humans have always have used fire in the past, and there were land clearing efforts to fight fire, and some of those escaped. I don't know, you know, in terms of the largest fires, whether you can attribute that to those. I think that in order to get a really big fire going in the Coast Range, you've got to have a combination of conditions that typically nobody would try to start a fire during that situation, but you do get lightning strikes then. So the Yaquina fire, the Coos fire back in the middle 1800s, the late 1800s, I doubt very much that those were intentionally set fires. We have no way of knowing.
No way.
But there were intentionally set fires, and there was a lot of land clearing, and that's some of why the laws were created the way they were to begin to regulate those issues.
Thank you. Thank you, ma'am.
You're welcome. Sure cleared up that myth.
I've got to find the right place here to get this.
All right.
Sorry.
That's okay. Oh, Representative Rubin has a question while you're doing that.
Going also back to the beginning, because you talked about the mission and having the three levels with life, the forest,
resources,
and then property. Federal government reverses property and forest. Is that right?
The federal mission. Yeah, the federal mission is lives, communities, and structures, and then resources.
Which also prevents the aggressive fighting of the fire a lot of times, because your resources are set in different places. Is that another area you're talking about when you're talking about?
Well, it's an area. Well, it is. There are a number of factors that are involved. Wilderness areas, they don't fight fire typically with any kind of mechanized equipment. Their priorities are in the community, so a lot of the heavy resources, the air tankers, all that, get prioritized to that first. And so then if you have multiple fires, some of the wildland fires have a tendency to grow while they're awaiting additional resources. It's not that they don't fight those fires as well, but in prioritizing the resources that are available, they get the lower address. And that's part of the reason. It's not the entire reason, but it's part of the reason that the Biscuit Fire in 2002 became a 500,000-acre fire, and some of the other things that are going on there. But clearly we were during a period where we had fires everywhere in the state, and I would have prioritized the Biscuit Fire as a lower priority as well, given where it was located. But hopefully it moved resources there and maybe stopped at 100,000, 200,000 acres instead of 500,000. But that's speculation.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, I'm having a bit of a problem here. I'm trying to bring up this other program.
Do you want to go ahead?
Chair Smith, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to talk off the fire program review attachment and just take a very few minutes of your time. So if you're all with me, this was an intensive effort of the department throughout this last calendar year. We began the fire review in January and basically are concluding it now. You know, our stakeholders and us believe that ODF does have a premier world-class firefighting organization. Charlie has talked about that. But nonetheless, you know, there continues to be a need to assure that we maintain a vibrant, responsive system that adapts to changes. And some of those changing conditions, if you read down on the left there, certainly the fuels buildups, particularly on federal lands, but they do also occur on private land, result in fires that resist control perhaps more than we've ever seen in this state. Two decades of basically generally warmer and drier fire seasons is that next pressure that's driving change. And then the folks moving into the interface, the changing demographics, that that complicate the business of firefighting. On the other side, certainly changing technology. We're getting better at fighting fire. That isn't always a good thing because it ends up creating some of the fuel conditions that we see today. Certainly the budget and cost constraints that all of us in state government see these days as far as the rising cost of fires, the cost of fire insurance, as well as the cost containment pressures. And then finally, decreased institutional knowledge. With the retirements in our agency, we're at a critical juncture now where we need to do something to rebuild that institutional knowledge. But at the same time, with our stakeholders, particularly our forest landowners, remove some of the barriers that keep them from actively participating in the firefighting system because they are an essential partner in our success. Concurrent with the 2003 legislature's direction to review the forest firefighting system, our state forester Marvin Brown directed that fiscal assessment be part of an overall evaluation of the fire protection system. And here are the goals of that fire program review. We were to evaluate the current protection from fire program, identify areas for increased efficiency and effectiveness, and design strategies and recommend changes and priorities. We focused on six key emphasis areas, and Charlie has alluded to House Bill 2327, and we'll be visiting with you in a future work session on the Budget Note 3 efforts. We looked hard at prevention, as Charlie mentioned. The cheapest fire to fight is the one that doesn't start. It also causes the least amount of damage, obviously. The forest fuels and hazard mitigation, basically we're looking to develop coordinated efforts for landscape-level actions and solutions from the valley floor to the ridgetop. That involves working with our federal partners and trying to ramp up those efforts and ensure that the fuels are being managed in strategic locations that prevent the loss of private timber resources as well as the loss of structures in this state. Protection coverage, Charlie alluded to that, and that's the unprotected lands, particularly in eastern Oregon. We're working to try to fill in those gaps where those unprotected land fires threaten forest landowners. We do have some proposals that we'll be carrying forward perhaps later as far as looking at some of the challenges for those rangeland fire protection districts. They're loosely knit landowners that have come together. We help them acquire equipment and training, but the reality is they maintain their funding through literally things like cake sales and other things, and insurance pressures are literally almost forcing them out of business. So we need to figure out a way to help them with that. Our business systems are badly antiquated. We have both capacity issues as well as automation issues. We need to move forward on that. And then again, I mentioned workforce capacity. We are facing a situation in the next decade where within our own agency, we won't have an adequate number of qualified and experienced personnel if we don't move aggressively now to try to turn that around, as well as working to build our stakeholder and partner capacity with landowners, with corrections, National Guard, and others. There's opportunities to do better, if you will, there. So where we're at with the review, basically the key emphasis area reports have been completed, and we do have a final draft of the fire program review that's being developed and reviewed now. The recommendations have been compiled. They were grouped by the implementation responsibility and approved by our steering committee for the fire review. My staff is developing an implementation plan for the recommendations that were put forth by the review, and one of the things that we plan to do is run the implementation plan by our stakeholders to ensure that they agree with those priorities, and if you will, then through periodic progress reports, they're there to create that pressure to ensure that we do come through on it. Basically, the fire review isn't destined for the bookshelf, and my direction to staff in terms of developing a proactive, aggressive implementation plan is to make it so. Throughout the process of the fire review, we were assisted by Oregon State University's Institute for Natural Resources under Gail Ackerman's direction. INR is currently assisting us with the synthesis and writing of the final report. In fact, Jeff Behand, a research assistant with INR working for Gail, is here in the hearing room today, and he does have draft copies of the final report background if the committee members would be interested. We didn't include that in the packet. But that's just a quick rundown on the fire review. We're pretty excited because it's an opportunity to continue to improve on what we believe is a good system, but nonetheless, with the pressures that are out there, there is a need for continuing to address those challenges and moving forward and creating a vibrant program.
Well, thank you. I think you've done a good presentation, and I appreciate all the information. I think, as you can tell, we're going to have continued discussions about many of these issues that are profound to all of us. Representative Haas, did you have a question?
Yes, thanks. Just on the part that you mentioned in the first half of that on what causes fires and prevention and how there's more human-caused fires here, I was just wondering if I could isolate any of that, if you have any data on cigarette-caused fires and to what extent that is a problem that is growing or not, or if there's more that can be done to alleviate that.
Chair Smith, the Representative Haas, if I can go a little bit of a roundabout way to get to that that answer, I'd first tell you that our fire starts are equally distributed in about thirds. Lightning starts about a third of our fires, and then the landowners who own and manage the land or their agents start about a third of the fires on their lands, and then the general public is responsible for about a third of those fires. Probably the two leading causes of human-caused fires right now are debris burning and equipment fires. Smoking has probably declined as a cause, but it's still, I think it's third or fourth right in after those. We still do determine a fair number of smoking-caused fires. What we can do more about it, I think that's one of, you know, again, one of those areas where mass media and education in the schools and, you know, that fire prevention is everybody's responsibility as part of it. But it's not a big part of our causes, but it's there. It's fairly constant these last several years. Tim, you have anything to add?
Representative Haas, Chair Smith, members of the committee, Keep Oregon Green is an important component of that education of the public. They were the director of KOG was a co-chair of the prevention group, and they developed and are working on strategies to try to improve the messages that they send forward to folks. But over time, I think Charlie's right. The cigarette caused fires have been on a decline. We certainly can provide that data for you, and we'll do that.
I think it would be good for the committee to have that. And I noticed in that you had the third. When you mentioned debris fire, are you talking cigarettes included in that debris burning?
Cigarette fires are a cause classification all by themselves, so they get recorded that way. But debris burning is mostly backyard. Well, that's where we have the biggest problem. Debris burning as a class includes prescribed slash burning. It also is backyard burning, incinerator barrels, anything that's where the landowner started out with the intent to consume some debris, but the fire got away from them.
Thank you.
I was just going to ask again about the slash burning issues. Are there new technologies that are making way to do to not do as much of that, but to get rid of the debris?
You want to
go? No, there's been discussions.
Well, the overall amount of slash burning that we're doing has decreased considerably. Part of that is that there's better utilization of the wood products on the land, and so there's not as much there to burn. And a decision to burn or not, different folks have different opinions about it. But a lot of the outfits, as long as they can find plantable spots, they'll avoid the cost of burning. Others want to burn to clear out the vegetation competition or the rodents and that type of thing that make it difficult to get a plantation started early. And then, a lot of the burning in the past was to reduce fuels on the ground. But again, the logging has been done such lately that that's not as much of a factor. We've also tried to reduce the amount of burning as a smoke management element. The technologies haven't changed so much, although we've switched largely from 20, 30 years ago, it was mostly burning in the fall, broadcast across clear-cut areas. Now, most of the burning is done in the spring, or more of it's done in the spring, and the fall burning is piles, largely, and most of the burning is piles. So there have been different mechanisms, again, to get the job done, be able to manage and to manage the smoke, but not so much that is technology-driven, I don't think.
Thank you very much. We're going to have to move on because it's time-wise. We have one more person to testify. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we look forward to hearing many more, and I'm sure we'll have many, many more questions.
And we're at your disposal anytime you want to talk about these things. Just give us a holler.
Want to follow up with them, I sure will. Thank you very much. Yeah. We have Paul Washburn here. Going to talk to us a little bit about the contracting issues surrounding firefighting. Thank you. And welcome. My intention is to get us out of here right away. So. Hopefully.
Hello. Madam Chair, members of the committee, as you know, my name is Paul Washburn. I am the chairman of the Pacific Northwest region of the National Wildfire Suppression Association. Currently, we represent around 225 member companies within the United States, of which about 70% of those are in the Pacific Northwest, and of that, the vast portion is from Oregon. The association has been in existence since 1991. We're represented nationwide by 6 chapters and 3 additional affiliate associations. The history of private firefighting actually begins in the 60s and 80s, where landowners, industry, provided logging crews to fight wildfires within their properties. In the early 80s, fuels and fire companies and reforestation companies became more prevalent, providing crews and equipment to help fight fires. In 1986, large fires in eastern Oregon, the state of Oregon incurred a large workers' comp claims, resulting in the state of Oregon looking at pioneering some pilot crew contracts for 1987 and 1988. In 1987 to 89, the first pilot crew contract with the state of Oregon and the first pilot engine contract on the Mount Hood National Forest. During this period of time, many issues started creeping up about the private sector. Some of the issues were fire chasing, inferior equipment, and lack of training. In 1991, NWSA was formed to push for training and recognition and to deal with the private industry's problems. In 1981, an interagency crew and engine contract was developed for Region 6 that included the National Park Service, BLM, ODF, and the Department of Natural Resources in Washington. With the growth of the industry, and use of private sector came problems with self-certification of training. The NWSA in 1993 got approval from the NWCG and the National Wildfire Coordination Group to pursue a memorandum of understanding with NWSA, which provided us an avenue to certify instructors and provide quality training to the private sector. NWSA also started work on a database storage system to track training in the private sector and work on a way to stop fraudulent carding in the training systems. In 1995 through 1999, lean years hit the fire private contracting industry. With those lean years, we saw severe downsizing within our industry. In 1999, NWSA met with the national fire directors for the BLM and Forest Service with a push for a national crew and engine contract. NWSA believed that there needed to be a tiered contract system that pushed up the standards to achieve in the industry. And since no one in Oregon and Washington was interested at the time in a performance-based contract, we asked for a national contract. In 2001, then-director Dennis Pendleton committed to a national contract for crew and engine contracts and started the long process to establish the guidelines and to hire a contract administrator for the program. In 2002, the first national crew and engine contract, Best Value, were awarded. In 2003, after the great success of the Best Value contract, they were renewed for the additional years of 2004 and 2003. The Best Value contracting in the private industry will be and will always be with NWSA to what we think is in the best interest of all parties involved. What we currently carry right now is an agreement to provide services when needed, as needed, and that's all. If in your packets, you'll see a graph showing the growth of private sector crews within the state of Oregon on the current agreement we have with ODF. Over a 10-year period, you can see on this that it averaged anywhere in 93, starting out at just under 150 crews, to 2003 at just under 300. In 2004, which the data isn't provided within this pamphlet, there was close to 300 crews available from the private sector. With the agreement, there came accountability, or lack of. We have always encouraged the agencies to find ways to oversee compliance within the contract, review training classes, discourage use of contractors that are in violation of contracts upon dispatch and check-in. Some contractors would show up with no radios, poor equipment, people who were unable to communicate with the fire camp in a language that was barriers. And we've also continued to push the ODF to move towards best value contracting, which would encourage the contractors to do a good job as they are performance-based contracts versus the current interagency agreement, which is a glorified equipment rental agreement. In 2002, there were 45 occurrences with private contractors that required different courses of actions from ODF. Several of those were late arrivals, possession of a controlled substance, English speaking, alcohol, sleeping on the line, falsifying timesheets. 2003 brought out 54 occurrences, fairly similar problems, crew performance and serviceability, English speakings, late arrivals, failure to provide provisions, underage crew members, standard crew provisions for food and water, etc. 2004, there were 70 occurrences. Now, 2004 was probably one of our leanest years out of the last five. We went from very good fire years for private companies in 2000, 2001, 2002, and 2003. 2004 was not a very good year. But through the assistance of our NWSA members and our continual push on the ODF, we managed to get them to open up and start enforcing more areas, additional areas of the agreement. Some of the biggest problems within the agreement were dispatch locations. People would say they would be available from Bend, but yet they would dispatch out of Salem 3-4 hours away. So with that, it was never fair to the local contractors that were in the area, made the commitment to the communities that they were in. They were competing against people who were coming from 3 hours away to be in the favorable dispatch areas. So that's why you would see in the 2004 tracking, while the vast majority of the problems were with dispatch locations and late arrivals. Currently, the types of contracts that private industry enters into with the various agencies within Oregon would be EERAs, or Emergency Equipment Rental Agreements. These are signed up typically right on the spot as you enter the fire through maybe a pre-season agreement where you've dedicated your equipment to that as a resource. There's a Region 6 equipment contract through the Forest Service, which is actually an agreement to provide, again, there's some pre-season inspections and some requirements written into it for training. Anybody can qualify to be on the call list, and there's no competitive process, and it is not a performance-based contract. The current Oregon State Interagency Crew contract is very similar to the engine equipment contract. It is administered by the state of Oregon, has some requirements for training, but again, anybody can qualify to be on the call list, and it is not a performance-based contract. Outside of the region, in Region 5, which would be California, they have moved to a competitive contract with requirements through the U.S. Forest Service, a negotiated best value contract procured by the individual forests. The National Engine Contract, which is, as I mentioned earlier, came out within the 2002 area, is a competitive bid with requirements and mandatory availability. It has a pre-evaluation of the company personnel and a history before award, and is a multi-year contract with unilateral option years. The National Crew Contract is very similar to the engine contract, with evaluation of proposed key personnel, company, and history before award, and is a requested best value contract. Training within the NWSA membership is a very important process. NWSA training meets or exceeds national standards, is recognized by state and federal agencies. We have developed a database that tracks all training by NWSA instructors. We have a training committee that meets annually to review all training issues within the association. We have a mandatory training session yearly for instructors to update them on the changes and requirements. Within our database, in the last 3 years, we have entered in 16,000 employees within our membership of trained firefighters. At any given time, we can provide upwards of, and have provided upwards of, 5,000 employees nationwide, not just within Oregon. As I said earlier, safety is of the utmost concern to us. Some of the safety issues that we face are safety of our employees on and off the line, personal protective equipment, fire weather education, driver safety training programs, leadership training for our crew bosses, crisis management, new training manuals are written and reviewed frequently, the development of a crisis management plan, and a team within our association to assist members if needs arise. Regulations that are governing private industry within the fire services are Occupational Health and Safety Administration, OSHA, U.S. Farm and Labor Licensing, Department of Transportation, both federal and state, Migrant and Seasonal Worker Protection Act, the service contract, in addition, insurance requirements, liability, workers' compensation, property, etc. Issues that are affecting NWSA members are contract accountability and enforcement. As I've briefly mentioned earlier, the enforcement of the agreement that we currently carry with ODF has been lacking in the years. They have increased their enforcement of it over the last 4 years. But we still feel that as the agreement is written, it is very hard to enforce it without some pre-season accountabilities by looking through and being able to choose in a best value scenario which resources best fit the needs of the state. Other issues that are of utmost importance to us are the driver safety training, crew boss training, drug and alcohol programs, hazardous fuels and fire prevention work. We need more work to hit the ground during the off season to keep our employees employed and keep them available to the state. Recently, NWSA did a presentation to ORAC asking that a new class code be developed specifically for firefighting, which would help us to create a pure rate, which would hopefully lower our workers' compensation expenses. We were granted this, and in March of this year, we'll be starting a pilot program with through SAFE and ORAC, where all of our payroll expenses will be placed within a separate classification of logging, so they can track our losses over a 3-year period of time to determine our pure rate for our own classification. In the past, we had always been put in with a 2702, which is logging class code. And the logging class code, we felt over the several years, was we were driving the logging class code down because of our vast payroll low injury. So hopefully within the next 4 years, we'll be able to get our own pure premium, which is probably the highlight of NWSA for the past year. Some of our other accomplishments are working towards inter-association cooperation and inclusion in a national organization. Currently, we have chapters in the Pacific Northwest, Eastern U.S., Western Great Basins, Northern California, a National Contract Resource Chapter, and a Timber Fallers Chapter. We have benefit auctions. Last year, we raised over $25,000 with donations for our members and vendors for the Wildland Firefighter Foundation. We strengthened the membership application process and developed an instructor's code of ethics. We strengthened the NWSA chapter application process. We increase awareness within our membership. We applied for a FEMA grant to develop driver safety training program. We've applied for a FEMA grant to develop a crew boss leadership program. In 2004, we received a grant from Oregon OSHA to translate entry-level training materials into a Spanish curriculum. And we're working towards a contractor certification program. And again, we work with insurance carriers to provide training in making yourself more insurable.
Mr. Washburn, Representative Burley had a quick question.
I want to go back to the contract accountability and enforcement issue for NWSA, and I think that,
state and federal agencies, for a number of reasons, are increasingly relying on private contract crews for engines and crews. And the charts show it. Nobody would argue with that. In fact, I think in recent years, federal fire suppression costs, about 60% of that is going to the private contracting sector. But I wanted to follow up on your point about the best value contracts versus the agreements, and the latter having difficulty with the enforcement and accountability, and what, you know, what's in progress trying to get that situation rectified.
Currently, the ODF is working towards a best value contract. It is expected to come out in 2006. They are developing the criteria right now within committees. It's very encouraging that they're moving towards the 2006. The discouraging problem would for us is that they started the process in 2003, early in 2004. So it'll be a two-year process to get to a best value contract in 2006, which we think is a little on the timeline, in a very extended period to reach an end result.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Yeah. Do you have anything else to finish up with? Or?
I just have one small item on the, as Mr. Stone referred to earlier, the convict labor within the state of Oregon is a very large concern to private industry. We feel that inmates should not be used on any work project, which would result and the displacement of employed workers or the impairment of existing contracts for services. In the back of the packet are two MOUs between the Department of Correction and the U.S. Department of Forestry in the Deschutes National Forest. One of them is with the Deschutes National Forest, and one copy is with the Region 6 in general to provide labor crews to do pre-suppression work. Some of the things that Mr. Stone talked about earlier in the fire hazardous fuel cleanup, things like that.
And you're opposed to that?
We're very opposed to that. It's very disheartening to have unemployed workers in regions and drive by while convict laborers are doing things that we feel we could do. Now, we understand the bill process that said we need to keep them working, and a lot of us agree with it. All of them, very vast majority of us agree with it. But we didn't think we needed to keep them working at our expense. While our employees stay home, you know, ask us, when are we working? When are we working? Those are jobs that we can do. And I was under the impression, an uneducated impression, that part of that bill and the purpose of that bill was that they would not compete openly with private industry. And we feel they have. We feel that they're not contracting out portions that really need to be at least a percentage of it contracted out to private industry.
Great. Good information. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any questions from the committee? Thank you for coming here. I'm sure we'll have you back.
What was that?
I'm sure we'll have you back if there's further issues on this, which it sounds like there will be.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I guess with that, I'll close the informational meeting. Was there any public? No. Oops, just checking. My intention on the committee is to meet on Wednesdays and Fridays, starting at 9 to 11, as long as floor session is still at 11:30. As the session moves on, as we get more bills, we have to go to the 3 days a week. I'll try to limit it to two. I'll try to get us in here and out of here on time. If you have any questions, please let me know. And our next committee meeting is Friday at 9, and the agenda's been posted. With that, we are adjourned.